Ante Up is your poker magazine dedicated to the everyday player and their poker rooms. Pick up a free copy at your favorite poker room nationwide each month. But Ante Up is much more than a magazine. Visit anteupmagazine.com daily for breaking news and each week download our award-winning poker cast. Join us on our action-packed poker cruises to exotic destinations and find special deals on Ante Up gear and great poker products at anteupstore.com. Ante Up. It's your poker magazine.
From the WDAE Sports Animal Studios in Tampa, Florida, it's the Ante Up PokerCast. And now here are two guys who think they know how to play poker, Chris Cosenza and Scott Long.
It's September 23rd, 2011, and you're listening to the best PokerCast on the planet. I'm Chris Cosenza.
And I'm Scott Long.
You got something to say here, so just say it.
Yeah, you know, here's the thing. Whenever we have a pro on the show, we always ask them, what was the highlight of your career? They're all like, well, you know, I've got bracelets, I've got rings, I won money here, you know, blah, blah, blah. I don't have any of that to choose from, right?
Mm.
So my bar is pretty low. But I think I leapt over it like Jack over the candlestick this week. I did my monthly, as I call it, donate money to the local poker economy while I proof pages trip.
Yes.
It's one of our local card rooms. You know, I always take the pages there and proof it. And what was funny, too, is one of this guy, he always comes up to me when I'm playing and wishes me luck. It's really kind of like my Buddha, I guess. I need to rub his belly or something.
Yeah, he rub his belly.
He comes over to me in the middle of the tournament. He's like, Scott, put those pages down and concentrate. And I'm like, the pages are the reason I'm here. I know, but I want you to win. And I'm like, yeah, thanks. I want to win too. But really, my job is the proof pages. It's just more fun to play poker when I'm doing it because I never get to play poker anytime else, right?
Yeah.
And it was a little $50 tournament. So, you know, hey, the way I was figuring is I could lose a lot more in the cash game like I did last month.
That's right.
I know I'm just paying $50. It's actually almost insurance, right?
Yeah.
It's insurance against losing more money. So here's the thing, though. I'm like a guy with two left feet when it comes to proofing. You know, last issue I went there and decided to play cash over a tournament and lost a bunch of money, unfortunately. This time I'm like, you know what? I'm going to go play a tournament. And I get there and everybody on the staff is like, oh, man, this is not a good day for you to be playing a tournament. It's the $300 every 15 minutes. Promotion going on. Playing cash today.
Yeah.
You're probably only going to get 30 people in that tournament. I'm like, oh, man. And here's the thing about tournaments, too. I was talking to somebody about this the other day, and I don't know what you think, but I really think, like, the 30, the 40-player tournament is the worst tournament ever.
Do you think that?
In 3 to 4 spots.
Yeah.
You know, you got to sit and go where there's only 9 of you, and it pays 3 spots. Of course, not obviously not a lot of money, but you have a much higher probability of cashing, right?
Right, right.
Or I like those, I like it at least 50, but, you know, in the 100, 200 range when, you know, you got a lot of chips and you can go deep and I think you have a better chance of cashing in that too, even though it's still 10% of the field.
Right.
Am I crazy on this?
No, I understand what you're saying. It's that's the threshold there where it's like when it reaches 100 people, you know, you're making the final table, making money, but if it's 30 people, you know what I mean? You gotta make the time 10%, whereas in a sit-and-go, it's, you know, you get to make 3% or some 5%, whatever. So, I totally know what you mean.
And the 100 player, too. It's just, I think you get more opportunity there. It's more give in that tournament, I think, to get to 10% because you got more people playing and there's potentially more chips. And particularly the way I play, I guess, you know, a little short stack ninja here. I need to be able to double up. And if I have a lot of people, a lot of money on the table that have done all the hard work for me and I just come by and double through them once or twice, I'm good to go. But when it's a 24 player tournament like this one was, you got to be playing a little sharper, I would think.
Yeah, 24 players, that's not a lot.
Of course, I thought that was the case, and it turns out I played my normal game, not by choice, and I ended up chopping this bad boy.
Wow. That's the highlight of your life, is chopping a 24-player tournament?
No. Here's the thing. I listened to the details of the tournament here, and I am sure that you will almost kind of, sort of, squishy-like, be impressed with me.
Okay. We'll see.
All right. The only hand I voluntarily put money into the pot in the first four rounds, and this was a 20-minute round tournament, so that was more than an hour, almost an hour and a half.
Right.
Was completing my small blind on the second hand of the tournament. And then I folded quickly a bet on the flop.
Holy cow.
So for four rounds and the break, for an hour and a half, I played one hand, the small blind. Most of the time that my big blind was raised. Any hand I didn't play that, or I just checked and completely missed the flop and got out. That's a long time to go without playing a single hand, is it not?
Oh, my God. That's crazy. That's like, where do you, you know, the personification of ABC? I mean, what the hell?
Well, here's the thing. In the middle of that, or not in the middle, towards the end of that, I was starting to think, gosh, I really wish this was an online tournament in the fact that I'd have a hand history.
Yeah.
And I would be able to give it to somebody like Lee Childs or somebody smarter than me and say, dude, what would you have done here? And I'm not saying that there's nothing I could have done, because obviously there was. I'd be honestly interested in how someone would play the tournament I did, because literally every hand was like king tray or 9-3 or something like that. I mean, cards that just did not work well together at all. And the spots where you normally would raise, it would, you know, with any two cards, it didn't matter. You're playing position or playing people. People just weren't cooperating. You know, it was being raised beforehand, or there were dangerous people after. So I just sat there, and I was just, because I'm proof of the pages, right? So
yeah.
I'd almost rather not get involved. It actually makes me play a little tighter, because I'm like, oh, hey, I'm in the middle of this great story. Ace, queen suited, then never go down with the queen in your hand, fold. So I play a little tighter than that, right?
Okay.
All right, so these four rounds, we started with like 6,000 chips. All right. So even through these four rounds, I really wasn't short stacked at that point, because the Andes hadn't kicked in until right at that point. So really, I still had a fairly good percentage of my starting stack. Obviously, other people were building their stacks up a little bit. So I was looking at another short stack player, and we were both joking about how we were just sitting around waiting for aces. You know, because everybody says, hey, you can't wait for aces, right?
Yes.
But I did. And so, you know, I looked down, literally two hands after she joked with me, and I looked down, I had ace-ace. Small blind, shoved it all in. I got called by the big blind with jack four, I believe, and doubled through. All right, from there on out, I played just seven hands the entire tournament, Chris.
Well, wait. So wait. But what? At what point was that ace ace? Was that after the first four rounds? Was that the fifth round?
Yeah, that was round the fifth or sixth round.
Okay, because I'm just trying to. You were saying you had a pretty decent stack still, and then now you're shoving the first decent hand. So I didn't know how to look.
I think I was down to 2,500 on that ace ace.
Okay.
So it doubled up to $5,000 plus the ante.
Okay.
All right. So from there on, I played just seven hands: ace, king, jack, king, queen twice, queen, queen twice, and jack, jack.
So it's ace, king, jack, ten, king, queen, king, queen, 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 jack, jack.
Oh, just two queen, queens. But yeah.
That's what I said. King, queen, king, queen, 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 queen. Jack, jack.
Hey, that's three times fast. And all of them I shoved.
He shoved with jack, ten, too, huh?
Well, at that point, you know, I had less than 10 big blinds almost every single time, other than until it got to, like, the last jack-jack, I think, at that point. I was getting flush with chips then, but still it made sense, obviously, with jack to, I think we were four-handed at that point, paid the top three, and I wanted to get isolated against the short stack. Of course, he folds, and the big stack calls, so I double through more again, but...
How many times were you called during that string of seven hands?
Yeah, I was going to say, I the ace-king, I was not called. The jack-ten, I called for less and got lucky. The king-queen, I called for less and got lucky. The second one, I was not called on. Both queens, I was called on. And the jack, actually, I wasn't called on.
Okay. Wow.
I ended up chopping the tournament, you know, made more than $100 profit, which is hilarious, because a 24-player tournament, you're just, like I said, I mean, you're just, you're not going to make a lot of money even if you cash.
Right.
And we did a chop because this guy just wanted to get out of there, which is hilarious, because he had a massive stack at one point, and we chipped away at him. Hey, you want to chop? Okay, sure. So here's the thing, I looked at my little BlackBerry when I left. The tournament lasted 4 hours and 23 minutes, Chris.
Oh, man.
I played a total of 9 hands. All of them for all my chips except for that small blind completion.
Oh, my God.
And I was behind on only two of them.
nine hands.
9 hands in 4 hours and 23 minutes and cashed.
Oh, my God.
So, see, tournament of my career.
That's one hand every 30 minutes.
It is.
Roughly. Wow.
In a tournament.
Wow, that's crazy. Now, I have to say that I have never in my life played a four-hour tournament and got remotely close to ace-king, jack-ten, king-queen, king-queen, queen-queen, queen-queen, jack-jack.
Yeah.
So for you to get that in the last, what would appear to be last hour and a half, is remarkable to me.
It is. It was a remarkable run of cards. But I think it was also remarkable how crappy the cards were beforehand.
Yeah, it all balanced
out. And I was honest. The lady that was like, hey, we're just waiting for aces, and I'm like, you know what? And she's like, you must be really getting bored over there. And I'm like, you know what? I'm not. I much prefer getting hands like that that don't get me in trouble than if I would have got Jack 10 like seven times, a hand that I overvalue.
Yeah.
And would have been playing back at people and been terrible. I mean, when I get a King Trey, there's no decision for me for the most part.
Yeah, right. Well, before we move on to anything else on this tournament here, I have to say that I'm thoroughly disappointed, though.
All right.
Because, frankly, you chopped. And I remember a sort of snotty Scotty who was at a table with a guy who wanted to chop, and Scott's like, with all due respect, I want to play it out. Yeah. What happened?
Here's exactly what happened. I really did not want to chop this. And the reason was the guy who was the massive chip leader was later described by some other players as a thug. Which I think it's a good description. He was one of the guys with the big baseball hats, you know?
Yeah.
And weird glasses, and I got a story about him later on, which will kind of explain a little bit more about what I meant. And he was just running over the table, but getting cocky. And at that point, I had built up enough chips that I thought I could battle this guy. And then the other player was a woman who I had played with the entire tournament and was pretty strong. And so as soon as we got down to three, he's like, hey, you guys want to chop? And I really didn't want to. And then I was happy when the woman said, you know what? I kind of feel like playing. And so I can say, yeah, you know what? Hey, I'll chop. But hey, if she wants to play, I want to play too. So he played like three or four more hands before he brought it up again, and she eventually wanted to chop. So really the only reason I decided to chop is that I got to the card room early to start proofing pages and had lunch.
Oh, yeah.
And I was done halfway through this tournament, proofing pages. And I had work to do back in the office.
Yeah, yeah.
So I'm like, all right, you know what? If I could chop here, I'll take the money and go. But I really, honestly, I really, really wanted to play this out because I think I could have, like, beat this kid. And I probably would have needed an escort to my car. not just that night, but every night. But I wasn't. But it'll be, this guy was pretty funny. And he was a funny kid, too. I don't know what I'm saying. I mean, I've played against worse people that are just, you know, rotten to the core.
Yeah.
Earlier in the tournament, we had a long discussion about the check the nuts rule.
Yeah.
You know, we talked about in the show, or if you're the last to act and you have the nuts and you don't bet, it's a penalty, or it could be a penalty.
Yeah.
Because it's, unethical collusion, blah, 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 blah. And a lot of debate over whether that's really the case. In fact, actually, I've been on the Poker TDA forum, and there's a lot of debate between tournament directors over whether this rule is necessary or not, right?
Yeah.
But it came up in this tournament. There was a player at the on the other table. His first time playing a tournament ever. Made the final table with the most chips and went out second on the final table.
Oh, man.
Easy come, easy go, right, when you're beginning.
Yeah.
But he did that. He checked the nuts on the river. Of course, obviously, his first time playing. I don't think he really realized what was going on. He might not even realize the nuts. I wasn't at that table. But his dad was at my table, so he came over, and so they started talking about it. And at my table, half of the people had heard the rule and understood it, and the other half hadn't and were shocked by it.
Well, you know what? That doesn't really surprise me, because I have to admit that while playing in the last, 7 years, we've been playing this game pretty seriously now, I don't ever remember it happening to me. And so it literally took about 4 years ago for me to read the Linda Johnson article that was in Card Player once, where she described the soft play rule to someone, and it was like a writer-submitted question or something. Anyway, and I had never heard of the soft play rule until about then. So for people who just casually show up at a poker tournament and play every once in a while, and it's not a million-dollar prize pool, so people aren't really getting really harsh about things, I can understand that. I can figure that out. But yeah, it is somewhat surprising that people don't get why it's why it's a penalty. But yeah, I understand that they wouldn't know of the penalty itself, because like I said, yeah. I've never seen it happen in any tournament I was in.
I'm trying to think whether I even knew about it before it happened at that circuit event that we both played in, where the guy got a one-round penalty.
Yeah,
I think that's probably when it first came on my radar. You know, but you, and you're right. I'm going to check the notes. What's wrong with that? So, but you know, what's funny is we tried to explain it to those people, and they really just didn't get it. Hmm. Actually, one of them did, but then said, you know, hey, is the penalty worth it? And you know, here's a discussion I think I would have. It was a one round penalty for this player. Seems to me that there's some discretion involved there, where it could maybe a one hand penalty or something.
Yeah.
Or a warning the first time it happens. You know, I guess that's, you know, obviously from room to room they can do it. There's no rule that says you have to set somebody out for a round. But it seems like there are other things that are worse to me at the table that get you the same one-round penalty.
I agree. It's just, I guess maybe they're thinking to the degree of how often something like this happens. Like, if you gave somebody a warning for this, how often are you going to, again, be in that same situation with the person you could be colluding with, where you have the nuts and you're last to act, and then you check it again? You know what I mean? It's almost never going to happen. So I think they're thinking, all right, we need to penalize you now so that you don't do it again in another tournament or something. You know what I mean? That's, I wonder. I don't know. I don't know the reasoning behind it, but I can't see it being a warning being enough either. In one hand, Roy, what's one hand, too? So I don't know.
Well, true. There's something to be said about being consistent, too. So,
yeah,
you know, hey, I know you didn't know, I'm sorry, but that's just the way the rules are here, because, you know, we're not going to make the decision on whether you knew or not, because we don't know whether you knew or not. There's no way for us to know for sure.
Exactly.
But, you know, I just, I don't know. It seems like the first time it happens, and I think it also depends on the time of the tournament. And actually, his dad was actually pretty cool about it. He's like, you know, hey, son, you know, if you're going to sit out a round, this is the time to do it. It was like 5,100.
Yeah.
But no ante at that point. So it cost him 150, and, you know, it's no big deal. I mean, if this happened at the final table,
yeah,
you know, with antes and, you know, everybody short stacked, it would be a death blow to you. So, you know, just learn from it and go on. But speaking of penalties, my thug friend here, we had the final table. I had a player move all in. We had another guy call most of his chips off. He didn't shove them all in, but called. And then this thug went all in and turned to the guy that called and said, save your chips. And, of course, to his credit, the guy he was talking to said, hey, man, I know you're not supposed to say that. And they had to call the floor over. And the kid explained, he's like, you know what, hey, I know this is wrong. I mean, here's the thing. I mean, I know now that he has aces. I really should fold. But, you know, I put most of my stack in, so if he hadn't said anything, I would probably be calling anything else, so I'm just going to call. So it all worked out amicably, right?
Yeah.
The guy did have aces and knocked both of them out, which was great for me. And then they gave him a run-round penalty for saying, save your chips.
Right.
All right. So he's on the rail, right? And he comes back every once in a while to check, and they're like, you know, hey, you can't be sitting at your seat. He's like, okay. He's like, do the deal. Show me my cards.
Show me my cards.
And the dealer's like, I can't do that. And of course, and the poker room manager sitting right there too. You know, not the dealer obviously would never have shown him his cards. He's like, well, when I'm on the rail over at the other room, the dealers always show me the cards. So everybody was kind of laughing about the other line, room showing him the cards, and I'm laughing because when I'm on the rail, this guy obviously spends quite a bit of time on the rail.
This isn't his first time getting a penalty.
Yeah. You know, made me think of that, the line in Shawshank, you know, where the kid comes to prison and, I spent some time there, And Tim Robbins goes, you know, maybe you should change your career. Obviously, you're not very good at this thieving thing. And I went to tell this kid the same thing. Like, you know what? If you spend a lot of time on the rail, maybe you should look at the reason why.
Oh, man, that is too funny. Oh, my God.
All right, but it's not as funny as this submission that this great idea we got from our friend Father Paul.
I read this. The other thing, too, is that I want to know if, when this is all over, if you think the same thing I was thinking as I was reading it, but I'll ask you when it's all over.
All right, you know, Father Paul doesn't write as often as he used to, but every time he writes, it's pure gold. And this actually came a couple months ago. We just had so much to talk about on the show that we kept holding it until now. But now it's time to give Father Paul his due here. You know, because we were talking about our favorite game shows back. I think we were talking about Card Sharks or something like that.
Yeah.
I can't remember the whole bit we were doing, but... but he wrote in and says, I think we should add a match game segment to the show.
And we have people sit. And we were talking about match game too, I think. That was one of the things we were talking about too, just a little while ago. Yeah, that is funny.
And he wants us to have people send in responses to match Chris Scott and a celebrity panel of maybe Faso, the Stuck in the 80s guys, Columbo from his remote location in Belarus, or wherever he went to, and maybe Gabe Kaplan now that he needs work. And aside, he said, call me crazy, but I liked him as a host, seemed knowledgeable about the game, thought like it was, but I digress. The segment would be great. Chris Cosenza can't believe his luck. He was playing poker with Dumb Dora. And, of course, I can't believe a fan of Match Game would not add, in parentheses, how dumb was she? he's playing poker with Dumb Dora. They both went all in, pre-flop as chip leaders, and when Dora busted him with her ace jack over his ace 10, Cosenza was the bubble boy and blank was in the money.
Oh my god. So here's what I got. I was one, you know, when I watched Match Game, even as like a 6-year-old, I still understood that there was an incredible amount of sexual innuendo in almost every single question. And just having Father Paul write it, and I mean, his stuff was, you know, when his example was pretty harmless, so, you know, but I couldn't imagine Father Paul sitting there and listening to, like, a, you know, 21st century version of Match Game and not blushing a little bit or something, but that is pretty hilarious. I don't know how we would really do it, but if we did, it would be pretty damn funny.
Well, that was part of my response to him, is that obviously our society today cannot handle a Match Game like it was in the 70s, you know. There'd be just no way you could have that much fun with that show, because everything's so much more politically correct now, which is, you know, not a bad thing. But, you know, that was certainly a slice of our nation's history that's gone forever.
Man.
But yeah, it might be tough. Maybe we can get Father Paul actually to be on the panel. We start this, and we'll see who the first guy is that sends in something about making whoopee.
Gene Rayburn, I miss you.
So I don't know how we would do this, but, you know, I always do this, put it out to the nation. Hey, if you want to do a Match Game idea, send us some ideas, we'll do it. And, of course, I know you're just going to ignore me, and this will be the last we talk about it. But if nothing else, it was good just to mention it, right?
Yeah. Like I said, man, one of the greatest game shows of all time, and just the innuendos in it were just hilarious. You'd always wondered, are they going to be straight with this one, or are they going to, you know? And I wondered, too, was it all top of their head, or do they have writers and stuff? It was pretty good. Good
yeah,
show.
Yeah, I think they probably – well, I think some of the dumber people had writers, but I think, like, the Charles Nelson Rileys, they did their own stuff. And, you know, the best part of that game show, too, was that you could drink during it. They're all drinking up. They're up on the days drinking and
– smoking cigarettes.
That's my game show there, man, when I can have a little scotch there, a little PBR maybe, coming up with my creative answers. Love it. I would love it.
See, that's why you got to be able to smoke in a poker room again. Just so you can sit back with a cigarette, have a drink.
All right, it's not going that far.
No, I'm just kidding. Well, I'm trying to bring it back to poker, that's all.
I got you.
All right, our hotline is 813-448-1120. You call it, we use it, and we've never used it before. We'll give you something cool. But this time, we've used Lauren, so.
Who's this Lauren you speak of?
Lauren from New York City calls in about the Rake and the Underground Games, just like we had last week.
Hey, Andrea. This is Lauren from New York calling in response to the call last week, where a caller was complaining about the Rake and New York Underground Games. And it seems to me he has the wrong idea. He was complaining that the games are 1-3 with a $500 max buy-in and everyone buys in for the max, and that the Rake is unbeatable. These games play huge. A 1-3 game at an underground club in Manhattan plays much more like a 5-10, but you're only paying the rake of a 1-3. And if you can't beat these games, you're just not playing right. Guys here go like 4 or 5 bets with nothing. So if you play tight, you're going to win a lot of money at those games.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting when people say, see, I wonder about not being able to beat, like, limit games, rake. But when I'm playing No Limit, I never think about beating the rake. I mean, I'm going to, when I win pots, they're pots. You know what I mean? So I have to agree here with Lauren, especially if they're playing bigger like that. If you're playing a 5-10 game and you're paying a 1-3 rake, who cares? Of course, I don't really know what the exact rakes were at these underground games, but it doesn't really matter. I
get why people care. I mean,
not that I don't care, but I'm just saying I don't think that I can't beat the rake. Either I'm going home broke or I'm beating the rake. So if I go home broke, it makes no difference.
Right, exactly.
But, I mean,
what Elliot was getting into in the discussion when we had on the show is that the losers are really paying the rake. I mean, other people like to think the winners are, but you know, you're right. You're exactly right. If somebody goes home broke, you know, they don't think about how much money the casino got versus the other players. They just know that they don't have their $500.
Exactly. And that's usually what happens when I'm playing. Either I don't usually go home. You know, I'm only down 10. I'm going to go home. No, I'm either going to have a profit or I'm going to be broke. I'm usually all in or fold, you know? So, yeah, but I can see the guys who like to just squeak by and try to earn a big bet an hour kind of thing. And so they're thinking, you know, how can I beat the rake if I'm only winning $3 an hour or whatever the hell it is? So, but yeah, to his point, yeah, if it's playing like a 5-10 game, you really don't care that the rake is, not that you don't care, but you don't really think about it too often because you're going to be winning so much more.
Yeah, and again, it's one of those discussions where I think you're missing the dollars by counting the nickels. You know, again, I mean, you have a choice. You don't play in the game, or you play in the game.
Exactly.
Which one are you going to have the better profit potential in? probably play in the game.
Let's see. I don't play. I don't make money. I think I'll play in the game.
Yeah, that doesn't mean you can't complain about the rake or try to get it reduced or anything like that, so I'm not trying to say that, but... But yeah, I mean, you just this idea that there's a utopia out there for anything in our world is a work of fiction. So.
Yeah, plus, these underground rooms have taken a huge risk by running the room as it is, so they're going to want to get as much money as they can. You know, they're not going to be like, "Oh, we're going to be competitive with the casino across state." You know, there's no way they're putting their you know, their welfare online too. So
we get our new player rewards card introduced. Play 7 hours today and you get a fuzzy sweatshirt.
And if you hit the bad beat, we're going to be sure to file some tax papers. So we'll let the government know that you hit a bad beat in our underground room. All right, well, I think I need to read the mailbag because I think he was asking about a limit game in this next one, wasn't he? Is that right?
He was, but... Yeah.
You're the limit king.
You're playing a lot more limit these days than no limit, though. Which
that is true, but you're still the king of limit in this duo, this dynamic duo.
Maybe the jack.
The jack.
Or the jester.
Well, I'm not the queen, so... All right, well, this comes from Paul Loop. He says, I have a comment or two about your discussion of the $2 jackpot promotion drop, and in the case of the Louisiana card rooms, a 10% max $5 rake. That plus the customary tip of $1 to the dealer, and in pretty much the worst case, a $50 pot takes an $8 or 16% hit every time. Can this rake be beaten? I realize that you have pointed out that the card room is in a competitive environment within the casino, but these drops from every pot due to the very nature of poker ring games are not sustainable. The limit games will die completely with the card room, the only winner over almost every player in a given time period. What do you think about that?
Yeah, I took a little bit out of his email because he had, you know, he sent a link to a website which did the crunch the numbers on this, and you know, you're right. I mean, people already talk about the 2-4 game not being beatable,
right?
At all, probably even the 3-6. Assuming that'll happen the 4-8. I mean, I guess in a perfect sense, I think it's a little bit weird to say the game's not beatable. And I used the example you gave. You know, hey, you won a $50 pot. You take $8 out of that's 42. Obviously, you got to take out the money you contributed. So let's say worst case, it was a heads up pot. So you put 21 in that. You still profited $21 on that hand.
Isn't that right? The best case? Heads up is the best case, not the worst case.
Well, no. I mean,
worst case is 3-handed or 4-handed, right? But best case.
Well, but
is
more people
up.
Are contributing to that $50 pot then. So you're only heads up. I mean, that pot. If you're heads up, you're putting in half of that pot.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. So that's what you mean by worst case. Okay. I'm thinking of the playing ability, not the.
No. But I mean,
I know
in terms of contributing to the pot.
Right. Exactly.
So
worst
down,
case,
so
you put in half
bucks,
that money.
You know, if it's 4-handed, then maybe you only put, you know, 5 or 10 in it.
Right.
All right. So, but you still made $21 on the hand. If you win $21. If you win every hand, you're going to go home a winner. So it's beatable.
Right.
Now, obviously, that's not going to happen. In a realistic sense, what he's talking about is that the money's disappearing from the table, right?
Right.
So my second point was then, as long as the game is sustainable, when somebody else sits down and brings more money in,
right,
that's not an issue. It's when somebody busts and no one sits down that the money dries up.
Exactly.
A lot like a Ponzi scheme.
No, but kind of like when you guys had the meetup in California and it was just the meetup people and no one put any money except the house.
Yeah, exactly. That game was not beatable because no one was putting more money on the table, and the longer we spent, the less money there was, and all of it was going down the drop.
Right.
But in general, that's not the case. People sit down, so... That's splitting hairs here a little bit. In the end, this is what we were talking about on these other shows, is that, casino has to make their money, and Paul obviously admits that, he understands what we're saying. You can't charge a dollar rake and make money. It's just not worth it. So you charge what you can, and the market bears what it can.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a reason when you go around to rooms you don't see a 1-2 limit game in a lot of places. Because people have already decided, hey, I'm never going to make any money at this.
Yep.
Right? And that's probably going to happen at 2-4 pretty soon, and then eventually 3-6, 4-8. But that's not, to me, that's not a rake or a casino operator problem. That's an economic problem.
Yeah. Yeah.
You take a 2-4 game back in the 50s, and that's a big game, right?
Yeah.
A loaf of bread is a nickel.
Yeah. Yeah, it's all relative.
Yeah, so I think that's what it is. So, there are other reasons why limits drying up, and I think it's mostly because of no limit. But so what I get his point, so, what I told him, and I think everybody needs to know, is that the best thing to do is to convince your card room operators to reward the jackpot money in a different way.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm certainly not going to tell any room operator how to run their room. There's advantages to doing it both ways. But for a limit clientele, you need that jackpot money recirculating in the room right away and in smaller portions where people will put it on the table, because you need that. It's important for those games that money keeps getting cycled through it.
Yep. So if there's high hands being hit all the time, that money's on the table. And
Yeah. Somebody wins $100 every half an hour, that $100, who's going to put that in their wallet?
Yep.
No, they're going to put it on the table and play with it.
Yep.
But if it's a bad beat jackpot of $400,000, that money's not going anywhere for a long time, and then when it gets hit, boom. It's buying a house or a car or paying off credit cards back in the economy. So that's to the point of the jackpot rake. That's what you can do. You can't do much about the room rake, I don't think. And of course, you're welcome to do something about the tip, though. Certainly, that's pretty screwy.
And the other thing too is, if I remember correctly, most high hands, they insist that you put the money on the table, don't they? Because I know that the last two times that I've at a table when a guy hit a high hand, they paid him in chips and said he had to keep him at the table or he had to leave the table. So
yeah, it's probably room to room, but I would think But again, the point is not so much whether you have to or
right.
It's just, it would make sense to.
It makes sense to, yeah.
Particularly in a limit game. I mean, why would you not want to put $100 back on the table in a fourth game?
Yeah.
You're not going to lose it any more than you would, anything less, because you're not going to be put all in. But
exactly.
So I don't know. That's my feeling, Paul.
I agree. I think that's right. And the other thing too is about, why you don't see like a 1-2 limit game, especially with rooms with bad beats, because everyone would sit in them and not play a hand until they get a bad beat possible jackpot hand to play, and they'll play it for a cheap price. That's why everybody sits at 2-4 when they have a huge bad beat jackpot going, because they want to try to hit that jackpot without spending any money or losing a huge stack. So
yeah,
that's another reason why 1-2 games are drying up for a limit.
All right, Paul, we appreciate you writing in, and remind everybody else to email us at podcast@annieupmagazine.com, and you too can win a great prize like Paul is, an uncut sheet of J-Design playing cards, the official playing cards of Ante Up. You can only win the uncut sheets, but you can buy the cards in the Ante Up store at anteupstore.com.
And you know what else, too, you can get at the store? You can get PMS Pokerware t-shirts as well, which sell our hilarious shirts for guys and gals. We didn't give anything to Lauren because he's been on the show before.
Oh,
but
that's true, yes.
But yeah, if you call in, we might get one of those shirts, so please call in. Hey, we got Call the Floor back this week.
Yeah, we got a lot of these backed up. People love getting the rulings.
It's good, though. That's what it's all about. A little give and take, a little education. Nothing wrong with that. I'll read it. It comes from Ken Young. It says, I was at a local casino playing 2-4 limit. A frail young man in a wheelchair was brought to the table by the poker room staff. He pulled out $21 chips, and the dealer asked if he had another 10 to make the $30 min buy-in. He seemed confused and said he had $7 and couldn't make the min. The floor was called, and the floor person explained the minimum policy and asked him if he would like to play 1-3 stud with a $20 min. He asked her if it was a poker, and she said yes. He said, okay, was put on the list and asked to be rolled to the lobby area. Shortly, I overheard a dealer at another table asking someone if they knew how to play a game. It was the wheelchair player. It was obvious that the young man didn't belong in the poker room. It was apparently left there by a cohort, as he had to be wheeled around the room by staffers. I understand we want to accommodate all handicapped poker players, but this man wasn't a poker player and was lost in the setting. Did the floor act appropriately?
I was very interested in what Jody had to say because I had some thoughts myself. But let's start with what Jody had to say here. He said, bringing new players and helping them learn the ropes is a big part of a floor person's job. There are way too many variables to this situation to determine if a floor person should have done something differently due to the man's personal situation. With the popularity of poker on television and the internet, we constantly get people in brick-and-mortar rooms who have no idea what they're doing. Yet.
Yeah.
Should we turn away people in the situation of a physical challenge simply because it isn't right to take money from them in the game? Absolutely not. Some of the toughest people I've seen playing have been in wheelchairs, missing limbs, deaf, or even blind. A few years ago, the World Series of Poker had a man who played with his feet. All these people learned the same as the rest of us did by taking their lumps while discovering proper strategy and bankroll requirements. My immediate reaction to your question is that the floor person did his job properly by explaining things to this new player and accommodating his being in a wheelchair.
Mm-hmm.
What do you think?
I can see where maybe they should be maybe talking to the player a little more about it. I mean, once the guy said, is it poker? And maybe it's kind of like, okay, maybe you don't understand the game, and maybe you should talk to him a little bit. Not saying that, you know, they shouldn't try to get as many people in their room as possible, especially new players. But if the guy wanted to play hold'em and didn't understand stud, then, you know, maybe you need to explain the game to him or whatever, or say to him, hey, you know what, this is a different game than hold'em. Do you still want to play? It's poker, but it's not hold'em, you know, or something. But, I mean, you know, he's in the poker room. He knows he's in a poker room. He has money. He knows he's playing poker. So it's still his decision to play stud or not. I have to wonder about the, you know, the guy's got $27 in front of him. Really, yeah. You can't let him buy him for $3 more, or somebody at the table give him $3. You know, I mean, it's just, that was the weird thing to me. But not that he didn't do anything wrong. I mean, a rule's a rule. If you want to be consistent, be consistent. But just seemed to me, if he posted his blind in one hand, he'd have been back to 27 anyway if he had 30. So what's the big deal? But, you know, I don't know. I mean, I agree with Jody, though. I definitely agree with Jody. I don't think they did anything wrong.
Yeah, to me, the question here isn't did the flack floor act properly. It's the question should be, did the floor go out of his or her way to accommodate this person? And that's debatable whether you need to or not. I mean, it certainly seems by the information that we got that no one did anything wrong here. I mean, the gentleman won the play. They actually were nice enough to wheel him over there, set him up, and then when he couldn't make the minimum buy-in, they found an alternative. Hey, all right, you only got $27. Guess what? We have a game over here where it only takes 20.
Right.
So I think they did everything they could. Now, the question is, you know, should they have said, as you said, hey, could they have made an exception there? Now, the reason they probably wouldn't make an exception is obviously this guy doesn't have any more money in his wallet.
Right.
It's not that he's just buying it light. He has $27 to play with. So once that's gone, then he's out. So, you know, you're going to have to cycle somebody else in. Or whether they should have been, hey, you know, are you looking specifically to play Texas Hold'em? Or what do you mean by poker when we say poker? Obviously it's poker, but
yeah,
you know, maybe you're trying to play three-card poker in the casino and you ended up here. I don't know. But
well, I look at it like this. When we go and interview all of these poker room managers, like we're about to do next week, we always say to them, what makes your poker room different? And they all say the same thing. Every single manager to a man says, oh, friendliness of staff. It's like a family environment. You know, when you come here, it's like playing in a home game. Well, let me ask you this. If we went to the poker room manager where this incident happened and we said, hey, what makes your room different? He would say the same thing. So then if I had known this happened, I might say, okay, well, let me ask you this. If your brother was in a wheelchair and sat down in a room and said that he didn't have enough money to play in your game, would you sit him down in another game where you didn't know and not ask him if he didn't know how to play the game? You know what I mean? No, you wouldn't do that to your best friend or your buddy or, you know, so when they say it's the friendliness of the staff and the, you know, it's a home game environment, blah, blah, well, you know, that to me, although they didn't do anything wrong, it just seemed pretty cold to not help this guy who has $27 in his, to his name, you know? So I don't know. I don't know if that's completely true when they say that, you know, it's their staff go over, above, and beyond. At that point, this person didn't, like you said, he didn't go beyond what he could have done to make sure this guy didn't just get fleeced out of $27 and sat around his wheelchair waiting for his friend to pick him up, you know?
Oh, yeah, I don't disagree with you here, but this is interesting that this letter is on this show because I think it's emblematic of what we're going to talk about later on the show. Directing your anger at the wrong person.
Yeah.
You know, really, the real loser in this whole thing was whoever brought this guy to the casino
right.
in the first place
right.
and just left him there to go do whatever and just assumed that people were going to be wheeling him around and get him in the game and take care of him. To me, that's pretty crappy. You know,
yeah.
my mom's in a wheelchair. I would never think of just dropping her off somewhere
yep.
and letting her fend for herself and hope that other people are going to help her out. That's just, you know, you just don't do that, you know?
King of the Deutsche Bankeries.
Yeah, yeah. So a part of me wants to say, you know, it just seems a little weird to me to get upset at anybody else in this situation other than that jerk.
No, right, absolutely. I'm saying, though, I mean, once you knew the guy, didn't know what he was doing, you know, I just sitting him down at that table seems weird to me, you know. I don't know, just especially
well,
since
yeah,
he didn't know what he was doing
I,
at all.
I guess the other flip side is, what if you told the gentleman, hey, you know what, I don't think this is really where you should be, and he flipped out at you?
No, that's true. I mean, yeah. It was a way of saying it, too, though. You
yeah.
know? Do you understand stud? Do you want to play stud? Because it's a different game. And then when he says, oh, yeah, I'll just try it out, then that's fine. You sit him down. But if he's like, well, is there a flop? Or, and you're like, no, it's not that way. It's seven cards, blah, blah, blah. And then if he still gets it or still wants to try it, then he's an adult and it's his money, so that's
right.
fine. But if the guy doesn't get it and you're just shoving him there because you want to try to get his last $27 out of him for the rake or something, that's just not right.
Right, of course.
So we're going to Immokalee, which is near Fort Myers. We're leaving in a couple days. Pretty exciting stuff. Scotty Wynn's going to be there. Going to the Seminole Casino September 24th. Going to play in some cash games down there. See the crew. Like I said last week, too, it's like my first time seeing the new room, so I'm pretty excited about it.
Yeah, yeah. It's going to be a good time out there. And like I said, lots of people are coming out to say hi to us. So we'll be a little mini unofficial meetup down
yeah,
there.
Yeah, yeah. Very
so,
good. Very exciting.
Come out and join us. And then we get one day rest, Chris. And we're at it again, as I like to call it. There have been dozens of people that called us crazy this year. Of course, there's been dozens of people calling us crazy since we were born. But Monday, we take a probably our craziest trip yet.
Yeah, this is pretty crazy.
Now, the Nevada one, we did, 76 rooms in 7 days.
Yeah.
So that sounds crazier than this. But this is going to be far more exhausting. On Monday, we leave. We're going to be visiting around 40 poker rooms in Arizona, California, Missouri. And when we say California, we're just not going to L.A. We're flying to San Diego, driving around south. We're going up to San Jose, driving around the Bay Area. Then I'm flying to Sacramento for some crazy reason and seeing some rooms there. So we are going to be two very exhausted puppies. At the end of this trip, I think.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah. I'm excited though because I've never seen any of the rooms in California. You know, we'll be in LA, right? We'll be seeing the bike and the commerce and just the huge, biggest rooms in the world, and I've never seen them. So I'm pretty excited about that. And not that I'm not excited to see Arizona and all the other rooms. It's just I've never been to these world famous rooms, and
right.
I've been to all the other ones really in the United States, essentially that are world famous. So. I'm pretty stoked about it. Also dreading the trip a little bit. But we'll worry about that for the next show, so we'll find out why
yeah.
I'm dreading it.
I was telling some people this week, our travel director is a real loser here at Annie Up. Every flight seems to leave at 6 a.m.
I know. Oh, my God. I'm not even going to sleep on this trip at all. I know it. I can already hear you wheezing on the mic, so I can just imagine what that's going to be like sleeping next to for the next 7 days.
No, it'll be better. It's all allergies. So
oh, yeah.
Cats, and it'll be fine. So, of course, we're going to be busy as anything, so no time for meetups. We apologize to folks for that. But we will be tweeting away when we're out there so you can follow where we're going. And a little reminder that next week's podcast, we posted a few days late. Once Chris gets home from the trip, But the good news, of course, is it should be filled with wacky zaniness.
Yeah, I don't think we've planned to actually sit down and record the show like we did in Vegas. I think we're just going to be like having the recorder running while we're driving around yelling at each other. So
a little stream of consciousness show. I like it.
So should be pretty good.
All right, and then finally, you actually have one or two days yet to get the 619 rate guarantee for Arnox Antioch Poker Cruise, sailing December 10th out of New Orleans. But after that, and by the time most of you are listening to this, you have already missed the rate guarantee deadline. But that doesn't mean you can't call us and get on the ship. It just might cost you a little bit more. But go to antiupmagazine.com/cruise for all the details. And give me a call. We'll get you booked.
Yeah, take a vacation with us. Well, speaking of vacation, actually, the Antiup News Desk and O'Malley's Move are taking one. Poor O'Malley, man. He works a week, takes a week off, works a week. You know, poor guy.
The guy's rough a life. Banker, man.
Rough life.
Yeah.
And, of course, the News Desk, we're taking a break. Because basically everyone talked about Full Tilt Poker this week, and that's going to be our main topic. So we'll just launch right into it, I think. I think we'll just start talking about what's going on, man. It's pretty crazy stuff. At first I heard it, and I was like, yeah, whatever. You know, we'll just be a little segment on the show or whatever. But it blew up, man. We need to talk about this today.
Yeah, yeah. Did I think the same thing as, you know, when we first saw it, I'm like, eh, this is kind of mildly interesting. And then you read more about it, and you're like, oh, okay, this is more than mildly interesting. And then, of course, you just see the chatter everywhere. And you're like, wow, the biggest news since Black Friday.
Yeah, absolutely.
All right, so we'll just start real quickly with what happened here. U.S. attorneys on Tuesday amended a civil money laundering complaint against Full Tilt directors Howard Lederer, Chris Ferguson, Ray First, and Ray Bittar, saying they defrauded players of more than $300 million by not maintaining sufficient funds to pay players. And just a couple summary points from the complaint. It said, and remember, these are allegations from the U.S. Attorney's Office. On March 31st, Full Tilt had about $60 million in the bank and owed $390 million to players around the world, $150 million of that to Americans. By August 2010, Full Tilt's payment processing network had been severely disrupted, and the company can no longer withdraw money from U.S. players' bank accounts. So Full Tilt allegedly accredited player accounts without actually getting the money, letting players play with $130 million in phantom funds.
Mm-hmm.
The named defendants each were paid at least $25 million from the company, some of them more. And here is the shocking quote. It was, quote, Full Tilt was not a legitimate poker company, but a global Ponzi scheme, Pribahara said in a statement. Full Tilt insiders lined their own pockets with funds picked from the pockets of their most loyal customers while blithely lying to both players and the public alike about the safety and security of the money deposited.
I'm sure that when Ponzi scheme came up, about a billion people went running to Google and said, what the hell's a Ponzi scheme? You know, I knew what it was just from our journalism background and stuff like that, but I just thought it's interesting that they're still throwing that around as the label for things that are similar to this, but yeah, why don't you tell them what it is?
Well, you know, I hope you're right. I hope that when people saw a Ponzi scheme and they ran and read about it, because I think they would see that this is not a Ponzi scheme.
Right.
There's obviously, if the allegations are true, and it's getting tougher to say that they're not, there was obviously fraud going on here. The thing was bad enough, but I think, here's my opinion, I think calling it a Ponzi scheme was the ultimate angle shoot by the U.S. attorney. And I've been whining about this on a couple radio shows I've done this week. And interestingly enough, Full Tilt finally issued a statement yesterday. Didn't really address any of this stuff other than the complaint that of the use of the word Ponzi scheme to describe it. And the first thing I say in all the radio shows this week is, I am not a Full Tilt apologist. All right, if you want to pick up the pitchforks and the flaming things and go at people, I am not going to stand in your way, all right? But I do have a problem with grandstanding, and particularly I'm going to get to a point why I think all of us should care about this U.S. attorney using this phrase, because I really believe, I have not talked to this Pribahara guy. I haven't interviewed him at all, so this is just my gut feeling. But to me, and I'm curious what you think, he seems to be out to destroy the future of online poker as well as the past. There's just, to me, to use a word Ponzi scheme to describe this is deliberate to get it in headlines and get people thinking it's worse than it really is, and therefore really killing the future potential of online poker. Because now you're going to have people every time Dick, Jane, and Harry that really didn't have a dog in this fight is going to go, online poker. I told you it's a Ponzi scheme.
Yeah.
And it's just not true, I don't think.
No, I agree with you.
What do you think?
I agree with you. And I do wonder, too, if it's his sort of way or, you know, the Department of Justice way or whatever of, because, you know, it's been a little while since anything's really happened.
Yeah.
And not that they were holding back this information to, like, hit us with it, but the fact that all we've seen in the headlines lately is, when's online poker going to be regulated? When's it going to happen? And all this progress that's happening, and this is the best time of year to have it. And every time we seem to make any momentum, boom, the U.S. attorney comes back with another complaint or, you know, whatever. So, yeah, I have to agree with you. I think that they might have – not that they're losing traction in the cases they already have against Full Tilt and Stars or whatever, but they weren't. There were no headlines about this. There was no forthcoming information about where those cases were. And to grab some headline, if they just said, oh, they put another person on the complaint, that would have been like nothing. That wouldn't have made the headline at all. But once he says Ponzi scheme and they've all stolen all this money or whatever, boom, it's going to be, it's on ESPN. It's, you know, it's everywhere. And, you know, if people are, you know, unjustly being stolen from them or whatever, or something like that happens, obviously these people need to be brought to justice. So whoever it is that did it. But to use words like Ponzi scheme just to grab headlines, because, you know, clearly it's not one of these things. And it's sad that when every time online poker starts to get some sort of momentum, they come up with this stuff. You know,
yeah,
hey, want to prosecute people, prosecute them, whatever. But don't try to discourage, you know, the American dream of actually coming up with a legitimate regulated system to make money for our country and let our constituents do whatever we want. You know,
yeah,
that's within the legal ramifications of what we say is you know, legitimate and legal. So, yeah, it's sad. It's sad. But still, tell them who Charles Ponzi is and what happened.
Yeah, actually, you know, we love educating folks on the show here. So here's the history of the Ponzi scheme. Charles Ponzi promised his investors returns of 50 to 100% by buying discounted postal reply coupons in Europe and then redeeming them at a higher value in the United States. Now, my understanding is what happened is back in the day, I think this is around the turn of the century, people like, let's say, in Italy, right?
Right.
They wanted to send something to their friends in the United States, and they wanted something sent back to them. They would buy a postal reply coupon, and they would buy it at the Italian rate.
Right.
But it would be honored at the Italian rate in the United States, even though the United States it might be more.
Right.
All right? So it was a clear profit potential, and nothing wrong with that. What happened was he went to a couple buddies and said, hey, look at this deal. Give me some money. We'll all make some money, right?
Right.
And then when he got the money and he got the postal reply coupons, he found out that the red tape involved in redeeming them made the whole scheme unworkable. And then he did an about-face and said, you know what? People give me all this money. All I got to do is get more people to give me money, and I'll pay those people off, and I don't actually have to do anything other than just get more people.
Right.
And then eventually, as always happens in Ponzi schemes, the new money dries up, and then the scheme dries up. So it's that last part that is the only thing that I think you could pin Full Tilt on a Ponzi scheme, because that's exactly what happened here, is they eventually just ran out of money to make this thing work. But my problem was, if you go back to the quote, is that it says, Full Tilt was not a legitimate poker company, but a global Ponzi scheme.
Right, so that means they had the intent to do it from the beginning, and there's no way that they did that according to the way that things went until right up until the end.
Yeah, so what this guy is asking me to believe is that Howard Letterer and Chris Ferguson got together around the kitchen table one day and said, hey, I got a great idea. Let's create an online poker company solely to steal money from players.
Yeah. Yeah.
All right, now, you know, obviously we're learning a lot about these people that we didn't know before. Though, again, these are all allegations, and I think there's, to some degree, some leeway probably, maybe, possibly to be given to Howard and Chris. They might not have known exactly what's going on. Not saying they didn't, but I really have a big problem believing that's what happened. Why would two players that were so successful playing poker, such good guys with good reputations, decide to cook up an online poker company just to steal? There's so much money to be made in it, realistically.
Yeah.
Now, obviously, what I think happened is along the way, some people in the company, maybe everybody in the company, made some vastly terrible business decisions. And then when they hit these problems with the UIGA, the payment processors, and then, of course, the Black Friday, those decisions really came home to roost. But the essence of a Ponzi scheme is that there's no product whatsoever. There clearly was a product here.
Right.
Right?
Right. And again, like you said, these guys were making a healthy living as professional poker players long before they had Full Tilt. And they just wanted to get their piece of the pie like everyone else, like PokerStars and everybody else had. So they created Full Tilt. You know, Chris wrote the program or helped wrote the program or whatever. And clearly these guys weren't doing it to, you know, to just pass money around and take it from people and then say, someday we'll just get out of this and steal all their money. And, you know, obviously that's not what's going on there. You know, someone made a bad decision somewhere along the way. I don't know if these guys know about it or not. I did read a little bit of the Durr interview.
Right.
Yeah. And, actually, I read the whole interview. But, you know, I agree. There, to me, although I guess the Ponzi scheme started out as a legitimate thing, but the guy recognized right away that it wasn't going to work and kept doing it. But I don't think that Howard Lederer, even Ray First, too, because Ray First is a stand-up guy. I don't think that these guys, I don't know Ray Bitar, so I don't know anything about him, but those three, at least, you know, how would they expect to look everybody in the eye and there's just no way. They know that that's pure prison time right there, that they did that, so they wouldn't want to do that. They didn't start Full Tilt and put commercials on TV and sponsor TV shows and everything with the idea of stealing everyone's money and then, you know, and then getting away with it. I mean, there's just no way. Did you really think that Howard Lederer would take $25 million or whatever it was, you know, in his pocket, knowing that no one else could get paid, and say, yeah, screw him, I got mine? There's just no way. I mean, I'm not defending anybody, but I just don't see how he could be doing that, knowing that no one else is getting their money, or there is no money, or there's no plan in place to get them their money, or something. You know, it just doesn't make sense to me.
Well, we'll get back to some of the stuff a little bit later, but I think the big point was that I was making is that they did not start this company.
Right.
Obviously, things might have changed during it, but... But, you know, so I guess what I'm saying is what's really interesting to me is when this came out is that everybody was talking about what jerks Howard and Chris are. Yeah, and I guess to a small degree, Rafe, because he's not probably as well-known.
Right.
And, of course, you know, no one, as you mentioned, knows who Ray is. And that's fine. You know, obviously people were upset. They have they put money on Full Tilt. That money isn't coming back to them. You know, if these allegations are proved true, even if a few of them are proven true, it's pretty dastardly.
Yeah.
And I'm certainly not telling people not to be upset at those people. But what I think is funny is all of a sudden, everybody's forgotten about Preet Bharara. Right?
Yeah.
You know, when Black Friday came, this was the most hated man in poker.
Yeah.
In the world. Right?
Yeah.
On April 16th, I guarantee you, Ross Hamilton woke up, opened his newspaper, and said, giggity giggity goo, I'm number two now.
That rhymes. Giggity giggity goo, I'm number two.
Hey, I'm a rapper in the small town. So all I'm asking our listeners is be as mad as you want at the Full Tilt guys. I'm not going to stand in your way.
Right.
But let's remember to be mad at this other guy, too. Because he is really a thorn in the side of us getting a regulated online poker. And here's the other thing, and we'll talk about this a little bit more, too, but it's just... You know, the more the sensational language comes out, the more heavy-handed the government's going to be in any kind of regulation. And that's a real problem that I think we, as players, need to be paying attention to.
Yeah. And I also don't want people to think that I'm just sitting here defending Howard Lederer and those guys or whatever. I mean, clearly, if you're the face of the Full Tilt Poker and you're considered a board director, you have to know what's going on at some point.
Or accept responsibility for now.
Yeah, and accept responsibility even that. So, yeah, I'm not giving anyone a pass here or anything. I'm just saying I don't think they started Full Tilt as a Ponzi scheme. There's just no way.
All right. Well, you know, I spend a lot of time because there are a lot of stuff going on. And one of the things that really worries me is that people immediately believe everything they read, right?
Yeah.
And I'm not telling people not to believe the government or anything like that, but I did think it's interesting on the Epic Poker League blog, which I was reading this morning, and we'll talk about that a little bit more. Boy, poor guys.
Yeah.
Epic Poker League. But there were a number of people that actually said what I was thinking, you know, where's the due process in this? You know, this is just further proof that our country has slid into a guilty until proven innocent thing, rather than an innocent until proven guilty. Now, you know, a lot of people that are charged actually are guilty, so who cares? I care when the cops come and put me in jail, because I guarantee you it's not going to be anything I did.
Right.
And I don't want anybody to think that I'm guilty until I prove myself innocent. That just, it's weird. So it's kind of crazy how people are already condemning him. But so I like to distill down to what we actually know, because like I said, you know, it's not a Ponzi scheme in my mind. Obviously, it's very serious, though. So
right.
Let's just call it what it is. So this is what we do know, I think. And let me know if you disagree or if you think there's more that we actually do know. When the U.S. Attorney's Office unfroze Full Tilt accounts and let them pay back players, Full Tilt obviously didn't have the money to do so.
Correct.
Right? That's a fact.
That's fact.
All right. And then in forum posts and emails in years previous, and this was mentioned in the complaint, Full Tilt employees said player funds were being kept separately. So if that's the case, there shouldn't have been any problem paying players back.
Right.
You know, when the May came and the attorney opened up PokerStars accounts, we all got paid.
Right.
Right? If you had money in Full Tilt. So that leads me to believe that either Full Tilt execs did pilfer the company or lied about the safety of player funds or both. There's just no other way around it, I don't think.
Right.
Now, the company previously claimed that one of its processors stole more than $40 million from it, but that still leaves six times that amount unaccounted for.
Yeah.
So where is all that money?
Yeah. Exactly.
So, I mean, I guess, you know, when we're arguing about this, we could talk about all the other stuff that's in the complaint if we want. But let's just keep in mind, they did not have the money to pay players. And they should have, because they told people they were keeping that money safe. That's what we know, and that's pretty damning, I think.
Sure. And I back on when Black Friday happened, too, I think they uncovered some stuff that said within the gaming license that they got or whatever, there was some line in there that said that they aren't required to do it. Or something, whereas
right, exactly.
where Stars was required to do under the license that they had with the facility they had it with or whatever, and so that shows you right there that since Full Tilt wasn't required to do it to get their license and the money's gone now, you know, it speaks volumes.
But yeah, I think that's a good point you bring up. Here's the thing: if that was the case, then they were not required to. Obviously, we talked about, well, even if you're not required to do something, maybe you do it because it's just good operating sense for your business. But if they said, you know what, you know, we don't have to, we're not going to do it, we can build our business this other way, that's cool, I guess, but don't tell people you're doing it a different way.
Right, exactly.
You know, and that's the problem. If you didn't have these emails or these forum posts or these other public statements that your money is safe, then it would be a completely different situation now. Now, then you're just saying, hey, this company was just poorly run. But the fact that you're saying one thing and doing another thing, that is where the fraud comes in. So that was really the problem in my mind. Now, obviously, I mean, I'm curious how many players actually spent the time to investigate these companies when they were depositing money and asked whether the money was being segregated. I don't think any of us really knew that. Some people probably did.
Right.
But the majority of poker players just said, hey, I want to play poker. Here's my credit card, or here's my bank transfer.
Yep.
Right?
Yep.
So, you know, again, it gets to the whole Wild Wild West thing I always talk about, but certainly it doesn't give license to people to steal from us. So that kind of leads me to the next big question. I was asked this on the spot on a radio show this week, and I know what I immediately answered, but I'm curious what you think. I was asked, what is the bigger scandal now, Ultimate Bet or Full Tilt?
Well, it's weird. Full Tilt, obviously, it's a lot more money that was lost and stolen from a much larger group of people, and you know, and it's worldwide. The UB scandal involved really what a couple of people and who were just, you know, Deutsche Banks. I don't know. I think when you add it all up, like I said, one thing that I don't want to do about this Full Tilt thing, though, is start to just say we know that Ferguson and Lederer are guilty of this, you know, because right. We don't know. We're trying to unravel this stuff and find out what's going on. Yes, they're board of directors, so they should know, but they could just been faces of the company and you know, who knows? They haven't released any kind of statements yet, so maybe they'll take responsibility. I don't know what's going to happen. So for me, to just blindly say Full Tilt is the bigger scandal, I don't know. I think that these guys didn't start out to make this a scandal. It just ended up being that with a poor decision by someone. And I don't know if it was these guys or not. Whereas Ultimate Bet, you know, I think Hamilton knew that there were super user accounts, knew that he could be a super user, knew that he could see the other cards, and nothing came of it. He stole all their money, and then nothing happened. The guy got off scot-free, essentially. So, other than getting his photo covered up at the World Series, you know, and you know, getting thrown out of countless poker rooms, probably. But I don't know, Scott. You're putting me on the spot. I guess I would say, as a scandal, it would be Ultimate Bet. As a financial slap in the face, it would be Full Tilt, because it gets everybody, including the common man. You know, whereas the other one, it was Russ Hamilton pick and choosing some top-notch players that he could steal a couple of million from or whatever. So I don't know. It's a toss-up to me. It's tough to say.
It's a truly difficult question, and I guess my gut, because I answered it pretty quickly, I'm like, by far Ultimate Bet on the show. And obviously I have more time to think about it, and it's probably not by far.
Right.
But I guess, you know, on top of my head, there's a difference between cheating and looking at whole cards and profiting off of it versus just being bad at business.
Right.
So to me, from a scandal thing, again, from what I know and what I believe, the Ultimate Bet is a bigger betrayal to me. Now, what's interesting about it is, if on Ultimate Bet there were very few people that were actually financially harmed by that, right? It's a very small amount of people that were actually cheated by this. Though lots of other people obviously felt violated that they were playing on a site that was compromised. So, whereas Full Tilt, there are I don't know how many U.S. players that are out money, but those are people that are actually out money.
Right.
And I suspect if I talk to someone who lost $600,000 on there, they'd be like, oh my gosh, Full Tilt's much worse.
Right.
But it's tough to say until we actually know for sure. We get somebody under oath saying, yes, I perpetrated a fraud on purpose and I'm sorry. When that happens, then that changes a little bit. But right now, to me, just based on everything that I've seen, trying to piece together, this was just one bad business decision after another.
Right.
That doesn't make it any better to the end person who was hurt, but I really don't believe that Full Tilt set out to cheat people even up to the end. I think they were just trying their best to keep their business together and just made really, 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 really bad decisions and got caught. So, I mean, because here's the thing I'm thinking about, too. If you read the allegations, where this really started to unravel, apparently, was when they just couldn't get the payment processing working for U.S. players, right?
Yeah.
And at some point, again, if you believe the allegations, someone there said, hey, we can't get this to work. Why don't we just tell our players that we've credited their accounts, their cards. We don't have the money, but unless we're going to make the money back and rake and profits and all that, so when it comes around to people cashing out, we'll have it. I really do think that's what happened here. And they didn't anticipate something, because none of us can anticipate what happened on Black Friday.
Right.
I mean, maybe what, 1-2% of the poker-playing public would stand up and say, oh, yeah, I thought that's exactly what was going to happen. None of us thought that the government was going to be able to shut down the U.S. online poker industry in a matter of hours.
Right, and it's not that you're justifying their decision either, because you're not.
No,
you're just saying
it's,
that could have been what happened, and they're thinking, all right, well, we'll get another processor lined up soon. And then the other thing, too, is that are these figures bloated because it's phantom money and people aren't actually out that much money, but rather that's the money that people won at the poker tables that really wasn't there, and that's the money they're out. You know what I mean? It's like, okay, you won $100,000 on a pot from somebody who didn't have $100,000, but you didn't financially lose $100,000 because the government doesn't think of gambling money as, you know what I mean? You know what I'm trying to say? It's like, I mean, yeah, it's their money because they won in a pot and they rightly should get that money, but I'm just wondering how bloated these figures are. Because after that payment processing problem where they started saying, okay, your account is credited $100 or you've deposited $10,000 and it's there, but it's really not there. Because the people who said they deposited $10,000, never really got that 10 grand taken from them if it didn't get processed. So they didn't route that. They're not out that 10 grand. But the person who won the 10 grand is out it because they won it. But they didn't, it's not like they took 10 grand out of their pocket. It's from a gambling site that really didn't really have the money anyway. You know what I'm trying to say?
Yeah.
So well, I don't know if those numbers are bloated.
Really does. Actually, the state, the company has said this in other statements. This really is, in a weird way, equivalent to a bank. You know, you go to a bank, you deposit money. The bank takes that money and it loans it out to other people and gets interest on it, right?
Right.
If we all show up at the bank on Friday and want our money back, guess what? We're not getting our money back because they don't have it there. It's right. out to other people.
Right.
Now, of course, there's safeguards built in and all that, so that's why I'm not trying to completely compare it to that. But that's essentially what it sounds like happened here is they said, you know, hey, as long as there's not a run on money, we'll be able to pay people out when they ask for it. And unfortunately, they were forced into a run on money that they didn't anticipate, and then that's when everything collapsed.
Exactly.
So it doesn't, of course, again, it doesn't excuse them.
Right, it doesn't excuse paying people $25 million in bonuses or whatever the money is they're owed.
Right. Well, that was over the course of time, too. I mean, you know, the other thing, too, is, I mean, here's the thing. Again, I'm not apologizing for this company at all, but I'm thinking about it from a business standpoint. If it really got to the point where they couldn't process U.S. players' money, what are their options? All right, their options are to announce to the U.S. players, "Hey, I'm sorry, we have not been able to find a good payment processor. We're going to have to shut the site to U.S. players until we can."
Right.
All right.
Right.
That's probably when everybody said, "Oh yeah, they should have done that." Well, yeah, they probably should. I'm not saying they shouldn't, but imagine the damage to the company in saying that. All right. From our standpoint as a magazine, if we come to the decision that we can't publish an issue 1 month, it's devastating to us.
Right.
Because no one's going to believe that we're going to be able to publish another one.
Right. Right.
If you come out and say, hey, we're going to have to stop serving U.S. players, and then you come back 3 months later, hey, we're back, you know, you're taking a hit, right?
Yeah.
So I think is someone said, all right, what can we do to avoid that? Is there something we can do to avoid having to do that if we take money from here to there? And that's probably what happened. So it very well could be that they changed their policy midstream too, you know, and maybe they weren't paying salaries out at that point. I don't know. But it's one of these situations where I think it's easy for all of us to sit back in judgment, but I think if you're actually in that situation, you might make a bad decision. Again, not apologizing for it. It was the wrong decision to make, but I can see how it might happen. Again, if you could look ahead and see a Black Friday situation coming, I don't think anybody would make that decision.
No, exactly.
Say, hey, there's absolutely no way we're going to do this if we know that there's going to be a run of money. It's not going
to
work.
Exactly. That's why every day you go to the mailbox and look for checks from companies who are advertising with us so we know that we can print another magazine. But we know I'm working on the magazine. I'm here making it. I'm designing it. You're there making calls about it because we assume we're going to publish next month because we're going to have enough money to do it or whatever. You know, I mean, your business has to proceed knowing that the money's coming in and you have sort of a, you know, a schematic of how it's going to break down and whatever. So I can see how they probably were adjusting on the fly. This definitely was like a domino thing, though. One bad decision led to another one. And
certainly it was bad decisions all around.
Yeah. But you know, again, now they're not guilty either. You know what I mean? They're still not guilty. It's not like there could be a decision that, you know, we don't know happened or, you know, we don't know. We only know what we're being told at this point. It's not like we're investigating this on our own and finding out information. We're only getting what they tell us, and this is what we know so far. So,
all right, let's talk about the future here because I got asked that a little bit on some of these radio shows. In fact, actually, I had a fairly funny moment that I had to apologize the next night when I was because someone said asked me, when do you think players are going to see their money? And I actually burst out in laughter. And then I caught myself, and I'm like, you know, hey, I'm not trying to offend anybody out there that's waiting on money from Full Tilt. But seriously, at this point, if you honestly think you're going to see your money, you're playing the game of Fantasyland.
Yeah.
Switch to Candyland, Monopoly, something else, because it's not going to happen. That money's gone.
Yeah.
In some cases, it never existed.
Yeah.
So, I mean, these principles might settle or lose in court, might get judgments, but you can't compel someone to pay back money that doesn't exist. I mean, you can, but I mean, it doesn't mean they don't have it. They don't have it.
Yeah, it's not like you're gonna say, okay, I want Ray Bitar's pay attached to pay me back my $150 bucks
for the next
garnish his wages. You know, while he's Well, who knows what's going to happen to him, but yeah, that's just hilarious. Yeah, I mean, I can see what you're saying. I feel bad for people who don't have money in Full Tilt. Fortunately, I went broke.
I was going to say, I'm not out any. I was out 17 cents, I think.
Yeah, I think I was out 2 cents. I went broke, and then we had our big flare up with them anyway, so I never put any more money on. So I didn't lose any money. I feel bad for those who – I definitely feel bad for those who have money on there. I think it's sad. And but, yeah, think of it as, hey, you've been living your life since, you know, April without that money, and just think of it as if it ever somehow did happen that you got money back some way – just think of it as bonus and buy your significant other something really nice with it.
But really, don't be sitting around your computer waiting for that money to come. I mean, you're causing yourself heartbreak. Now, I know people out there saying, Scott, there are people out there that want to buy the company, and they're saying that they're going to pay enough money to settle this and pay back all their players.
No way.
All right, I'm going to try hard not to laugh again.
Yeah.
But I'm just not buying it. I'm just not believing it. Now, maybe before Tuesday, there might have been somebody out there that actually thought that they could buy the company for whatever it's worth, pay the fines, and pay back all these players, and still make it a profitable venture going forward. After Tuesday? Are you serious?
Yeah.
Who was ever going to trust the Full Tilt name ever again?
Right, because it's not even whether they're guilty or not, or whether these things are all true.
It's the damage.
It's the damage, exactly. I mean, who's going to say, "Oh, I can put my money on Full Tilt now"? At what point do you say that it's safe to do that? Regardless, you know, all this stuff coming up like this, there's just no way. Which is why it makes it so hard to believe that any poker room or online poker room is going to be able to come back into the United States that was there once before and then left or was part of this whole, because it's just so damaging, you know. You're right. Maybe, and I think you have this in the notes too, maybe they'll buy their software, you know, and start their own site like that Rush Poker thing. You know, that's a very interesting, unique thing. That's their patent, their whatever, and so that will be the thing that someone pays them to get some money. But who's getting that money anyway? You know what I mean? So, yeah.
Yeah, there are valuable pieces of this company, but the name is not one of them.
Right.
I mean, looking back at Ultimate Bet, you know, after the scandal, they're like, hey, we need to rebrand. So now we're calling UB.
Yeah.
And people still said, all right, that's great. We're still going to call you Ultimate Bet. We know the whole deal.
Yeah.
So is somebody going to like, hey, let's just change the name to FT? People are going to flock to play. No, people are going to know it, and they just aren't going to trust that name. So, I mean, I guess the other way, when I really got pressed on this on an interview this week, I'm like, all right, it's hard enough to start a business. All right. We both tell you from firsthand.
Yeah.
It's not easy to start a business. But starting a business with both arms tied behind your back, why would anybody do that?
Yeah.
If you want to start an online poker site, start an online poker site. Don't buy a name that people hate.
And, by the way, give over like $300 million to pay back players, too, that you'll never see that money again.
Yeah. I mean, I suppose there's some goodwill if somebody out there, because people out there are probably going, I don't give a crap what Scott Long says. I'm going to get my money.
Yeah,
and when this guy, this white knight, knight on shining armor or whatever, shows up and pays you, you're like, aha, I showed you, Scott Long, you were wrong, and I'm going to return the favor by playing on this site. Yeah, okay, maybe that'll happen, but not at that same level.
No, and I hope that does happen. I hope we're wrong. Oh, I hope everybody absolutely gets their money back, sure, but just don't hold your breath.
All right, well, then I guess the next question, Chris, what do you think? Does this help or hurt the push for U.S. regulation?
You know, when it first happened, I definitely thought that it would help, believe it or not. I really felt like our government, or at least the people who are leading us, should look at this and say, we really need to protect these our constituents. And banning is not the answer, because our constituents are still going to find a way to gamble online. So if they're going to do it anyway, and we see that they're victims, because we're all idiots, only the government knows what they're doing. And I have air quotes going up, so it's not a vodcast, so you guys have to know I'm doing air quotes. I thought that they would see this as a sign that, yes, we are vulnerable. And whether it's true or not, again, these are all alleged stuff, but it just seems like it is. So, but if we're vulnerable, then we need someone to regulate so we're not vulnerable. We need safety measures put in place, because we're going to keep our vices, whether gambling is a vice in their mind or playing poker online is or not. People are going to keep gambling online, whether you say it's okay or not. And since they're going to do that, you might as well, one, protect us, because that's what you're there for. Two, secure the money and get your take on it, because that's what the government and the company or the country needs now, you know. And three, it's damning to Full Tilt, and it's damning to the online experience. And yes, throwing around words like Ponzi scheme are going to scare the average Joe, like 60 Minutes and the Washington Post try to do with their yellow journalism back when. But it's also going to bring awareness to it, and hopefully the people who were on the fence before might fall our way, and we might get some regulation. So at first, I really thought it was going to help. And I still feel that way, despite us fleshing out the story a little more today. And I feel like you felt like it was going to hurt it because the whole, you know, U.S. attorney's sensationalism of using Ponzi scheme and everything. But I really feel like this is going to push, you know. And I think I read who's the American Gaming Association guy, Frank. I read his statement, and he made it sound like we're pushing through something right now that's going to have us try to regulate, because we can't be victimized like this ever again, blah, 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 or something along the, us paraphrasing. So,
yeah, of course, I agree with him. That came out before this indictment on Tuesday.
Yeah.
But still, yeah, I know what you mean.
But you know what I mean? I just feel like they should be protecting us, and we're going to do it anyway. That's why Prohibition didn't work.
Yep.
So I feel like it might help, but it's hard to see that. You got to look really with an optimist eye and see it. But I feel like it might help. How about you?
Well, you know, I think in the end, I still do think that something's going to come out of this dead super committee, and maybe I'm just being too optimistic, but I really do think that it's moving that way. I just really, as I mentioned a couple times on the show, I just really worry about stuff like this poisoning the process. I mean, when it gets down to, if it's a close vote, like, hey, all right, online poker, here's a way for us to make a couple extra dollars so we don't have to cut these programs, who's in favor? Yeah, I was, but then I learned it was a Ponzi scheme. I vote no. That's a big problem.
Yeah.
And so, I mean, I guess what's fortunate is we only got a couple months left here before we'll find out what's going on with the debt super committee. But, you know, if a couple more bombshells are dropped, and who's to say they aren't? I mean, there's still online poker sites out there that haven't been caught up in any of this, and I guarantee you they're looking into them. You know, the more of this stuff that comes... depending on the language used and what the public sentiment is, I think it's going to be a little tougher. But I do think it's going to go through. But, you know, again, what I'm worried about is that every time this happens, the regulation is going to be thicker.
Yeah, strength, yeah, more strict.
Because they're going to say, all right, well, we need to protect against minors. Okay, great. Yeah, absolutely. We need to protect player funds. Absolutely, we should. Blah, 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 blah. And then eventually it's going to get to, well, now we got to be sure that it's not a Ponzi scheme. Well, what kind of safeguards do we need to put in?
Yeah.
And eventually, and I'm not saying any of that's bad, because obviously I think players want to know that their money is safe and they're not going to get screwed ever again.
Right.
And that's paramount. But what people also need to realize is all that stuff costs money. You know, the more you got to do to regulate it, the more, you know, checks and balances you got to have. It gets more expensive. It gets more tedious.
Yeah, those are salaries that you have to pay.
Well, yeah, yeah. So, and that's two things. One, it creates a barrier to entry. If somebody wants to create an online poker site, that's just more money they have to put in to do it, and they might decide, you know what, it's not worth it, or I can't afford to. So then you leave just a couple players in the market. That's never good for folks. And then, of course, just those costs have to be passed on in some form or fashion. So, you know, maybe the rake is higher, or maybe the rake back programs aren't as generous, or something. So it all has a cost. So at some point, what I think players want is a happy medium. They want to know their stuff is protected, but not overly protected. And the more this stuff happens, I think the more we're skewing towards the overly protected, which ultimately could hurt, not as much as it's going to help, but it would hurt a little bit.
Yeah.
All right, well, let's end this by just a quick talk about the Epic Poker League, and I don't mean to laugh, but, man, talk about somebody that can't catch a break.
Yeah, you know, I see what you're saying. I mean, I don't know. I mean, I see that they're suspending these people, but they're doing the right thing, so I understand that, you know, it's no slight on them, though. It's got nothing to do with them, and they're doing the right thing by it, so I don't know. I think you're... When I read this note that you put on here, I think that you're making it a little worse for them than it actually is.
Excellent, a good discussion. Yeah. Well, here's what I'm saying is, I honestly truly feel bad for him, and I feel happy for Andy Duke that we had her on last week, not this week.
Right.
But I mean, this is a league that it's had two tournaments now.
Yeah.
Two, and they've already suspended two players, kicked another one out, and put their first champion on probation. That's four people that have run afoul of the ethics policy in the first two events. Now, you know, I was joking on a show this week that, you know, obviously this league is modeling itself after the PGA Tour, and I was hard-pressed to remember the last time the PGA Tour suspended anyone. Did a little research, and it turns out they actually don't publicize their suspensions.
Right, unless it's so John Daly.
Yeah. So we don't really know what's going on there. But I think it just... To me, it's reinforcing stereotypes that poker players are low-life thugs here. That a league that's this new is already having to act on this many people. And again, it's only four. It's a small sample size. I'm not trying to make it too dramatic, but
right.
It just seems like this is crazy. And you know, I think the bigger issue that people are talking about is this ethics policy was put in place for stuff that happened since the league started. And all four of these people punished were for stuff that happened before the league started.
Right.
So they've had to do this complete about face, the two events into it, and essentially not change their policy, but all the rulings are such that, I mean, are they going to be forced to now do a vetting process on everybody that's got a tour card and kick everybody out that's ever done anything wrong?
Yeah, that's what I was going to say. It was clearly they didn't have the resources to do background checks on everybody in the league, because that's, even if you did a background check, you're not going to come up with stuff like that did come out. You know what I mean? Your background check on Chino Ream, yeah, okay, you're going to see that he got in trouble with the law when he was in Florida or something, but you're not going to see that he owes money to Joe Schmo, because that's not right. In any kind of way to find it. So I don't know. I mean, I feel bad that they're getting players that are in their league that are doing things wrong outside of their league, and now they have to sort of backtrack and get rid of them or suspend them indefinitely. One, I'm giving them props. They're doing what they're supposed to be doing by having... They don't have to have this ethics policy. They don't That's have true. To do this. That's and they're true. Doing it. So I hats off to them for doing it, especially since the commissioner of the league is the sister of the guy who's in the news now for maybe being in trouble. And they're suspending... She's suspending her own brother. And she has to, because this can be viewed as something clearly that is unethical or, you know, just not... In line with what they want their league to represent.
Well,
so
some people would argue with you, and they have to, because there's still allegations. And
well, I know, but as long as there's any kind of they until
from a public relations standpoint,
right? And that's why it's indefinite. They're not saying that he's out of the league. They're saying they want to make sure that this is, you know, when this is cleared up, and we know that you didn't do anything wrong, we'll let you back in. But at this point, you put yourself in a position where you can be looked at as someone who has done something unethical or illegal and hurtful to the poker community, and we can't have you in our league, so we have to suspend you from our PR standpoint or whatever they're calling it. But I just think it's kudos to them to trying to have a legitimate league that is full of people that you can be proud of and follow and emulate when they put it on television. You know, and they're trying to come up with that. And, yeah, I feel bad that they're starting this league at this time and having to suspend all these people. But, you know, I mean, if you have to be pretty into poker to know all this stuff is happening.
That's true. That's
you know,
true.
And if you're in the poker, yeah. So, yeah, I feel bad that they had that. But still, is the World Series, is the World Poker Tour hurt by this? Howard Letter is a two-time winner on the World Poker Tour. And, you know, Chris Ferguson's got all these bracelets and was a world champion. Is the World Series going to put a big black banner over Ferguson's photo now? And I don't know. But I understand that the Epic Poker League is just starting and now they're dealing with all this stuff. But it's not their problem. They're just suspending people. I think the league will be fine without, you know, with this happening. I don't know if it's in reinforcing stereotypes that were, you know, from the 50s, 60s, 70s, and 80s, you know, I don't know. Maybe a little bit, but again, these guys aren't guilty of anything yet either, so I don't know. I just think that...
It doesn't matter. It's when it's in the public forum, people believe it.
Yeah,
so.
I know, exactly. So, but I don't think it's that big of a... I don't think it's a black eye to the Epic Poker League. I think that they just are doing what they promised they would do, and I'm glad that they did it, you know? I mean, until these guys are, you know... not found guilty, you know, let's just keep him out of the public eye. I mean, imagine putting Howard Letter on the final table on TV right now, looking at him winning millions of dollars. You know what I mean? So they had to do it, I think.
On him.
Yeah, exactly. So, yeah, I feel bad for the EPL in that sense, but they're doing what they need to do, and they're being above board, so I can't fault them for that.
Backstage, the girls were playing five cards, stood by the stairs.
Hi, this is Cindy Violet, and you're listening to Annie Up.
Lily had two queens. She was hoping for a third to match her pair.
All right. Our show is quite long already, Chris.
Yeah.
And so we are going to use one of our situation of the weeks rather than our hand of the week. And we'll probably still talk about it for 45 minutes. So it doesn't really matter. But our situation comes from Maddie H001 from Australia. Yeah, I think he made an appearance on last week's show, right?
Right.
He told us about the rakes and stuff. In fact, actually, this all started because he mentioned that he was playing this live turbo game, which I still think is amazing.
Yeah.
That a casino can do this turbo thing. I just never thought it would be possible. But apparently they're doing it in Australia. So this hand comes from a local casino he plays in Australia. And he's sitting in middle position. It's a 8-handed, 1-to-no-limit game. And remember, it's turbo, so you get 20 minutes to act.
20 seconds.
20 seconds. Sorry, 20 minutes. That would be not...
That would be push cart. That would be turbo.
Push cart. Rickshaw. All right, so you get 20 seconds to act. And our hero has pocket fours, has $95 on the table. He says the table at this point has been loose moderate. Some but not lots of raising, with almost all hands seeing a flop. And he has a couple of limpers in front of him.
Okay.
Actually, yeah, we should just read through the whole situation, right?
Yeah, because it's a situation. I'm not really going to...
Situation. Okay. All right, so a couple of limpers in front of him. So he calls with this intent to set mine.
Right.
Hopefully hit a four and go. A couple more limp. And then the button raises to $8. Okay. Big blind and under the gun call. So he goes ahead and calls as well, too. He still thinks that the set mining is worth it at this point. And he says, given the size of the game, the small stake at the casino and the table image, I imagine most players have a wide range. $35 in the pot after the rake. Now he's got 90 bucks in his stack. At the button and big blind have him covered.
Okay.
Flop comes king of clubs, four of clubs, ten of clubs. So he set mine well, but obviously flush on board.
Right.
And the big blind bets $40. The under the gun pushes for $52, and our hero tanks. And as he's tanking, he looks at the button and determines the button is finished with his hand and will not be a player. And that ends up happening anyhow. So he decided he's unlikely that he's dominated by the big blind or the under the gun. He can't see either of them with the set, as both would have raised pre-flop. A big blind could have trip tens, but the combination of the overbet and the uncertain persona gives him the impression that he's on a flush draw with the king for top pair. It's the action by the under the gun that's got our hero a little bit bothered. Obviously, he knows the under the gun only had one play here. You're not going to call and leave 12 bucks behind, so he had a shove. So he ends up convincing himself that that player would have raised preflop with kings or tens, and at this point, at worst, he's behind to a flush. Given the loose nature of the table as well as the stakes, indicates that even the hand ranges could and probably are wider. Overall, this would leave him 10 outs by the turn to make a boat if he's not ahead. Given the size of the pot, he decides to push all in. The button does fold. The big blind thinks for a second before calling. And they turn with the cards. Big blind had ace-king offsuit. Under the gun, had pocket eights. The turn was a blank. The river's a club. They give the pocket eights a flush, and our hero wins the side pot.
Okay.
Whew. All right, so here's the situation. Was the decision on the flop a good one, given A, the read on the button, and B, the extra value fold equity to be gotten out of the big blind, given the actions of the under-the-gun pre-flop?
I think A, because he knew the button was, he felt that the button was going to fold. I mean, I like the idea of if you know he's going to fold, then you're only going to be up against one more player. You know, you're already, the under the gun is already committed. So I don't mind the shove there to try to isolate against the under the gun person who shoved. So yeah, knowing the button was going to fold, thinking, putting the big blind on the hand range that he did. I don't necessarily, let me look back at the hand when he was talking about, someone had, let me see, 10 ounce. Okay. So he felt that, was it the big blind? He felt the big blind had a pair and a flush draw. Was that what he said? Was the end of the,
yeah, he thought he had a king top pair.
Yeah, so that seems weird to me that, yeah, he would bet. I mean, to me, if that's what the bet sell tells him, that he has top pair with a flush draw, then I like the shove. If he believes that, then yeah, he knows that. I mean, I don't know. If I had top pair with a flush draw, it depends on how high my flush draw is. I don't know if I'm going anywhere as the big blind. It depends on how high my flush draw is.
Well, if that's the case, then you definitely want him to call.
Yeah, yeah, that's what I'm saying. I want him to call. So, yeah, I don't mind if you get isolated or not, either way.
Right.
Because one guy's already all in, so nothing you can do about him. And we have outs, even if the guy does have top pair of flush draw. So you want him, you know, you want him to call. So I don't have a problem with the shove on either account. I think that they're both, you know. The other thing was that the under-the-gun player, he limped, then called a raise preflop, and then shoved for 52. To me, it says that he is, like, protecting something. That it would seem to me that he's protecting something, or since he know he probably couldn't protect for just $12 more, he might have a redraw to a flush. So I don't know, like, now that we know the guy had pocket eights and it had a flush draw, the eight isn't a very high flush draw. So I'm trying to figure out what he's thinking there for shoving. To me, that's a bad shove. Because he's not going to get the big blind to fold for $12. But if, you know, when we shove for another 40 or whatever it is, then the big blind might fold. So the under the gun couldn't possibly have known that. So to me, the under the gun player, that was just a horrid shove. But I don't know. It's hard to answer B. A, I'm fine with A. B, it's hard to answer. When I looked this over before, too, it's hard to answer B for me. I think that it's a good... it's a good shove, but...
Well, here's the thing with the B, that, and maybe I'm looking at this wrong. If he really did believe his read, that this guy was on a flush draw with top pair, I don't want him going anywhere, right?
Yeah, the big blind, yeah.
Big blind. If I call and then let him... he probably is not going to bet on the turn without improving. Maybe he will. I want him to stay in and take another shot and get the money. I don't think necessarily that he's going to call, though he very well might. I mean, obviously he knows it better than we do.
But here's the thing, though.
I don't know.
Here's the thing, though. There's dead money in the pot if you can get him to fold. There's $40 dead money for the equity. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So, and then there's... I think that trying to isolate and getting the big blind to fold is probably a good... I would rather take my chances against one guy, and if I have to hit my... You know, because the other thing too is the
but
big
here's
blind.
The other thing too is the under the gun. I mean, I would really, if I'm fearful of anyone already having the flush, it's the under the gun player.
See, I would think that it's the big blind. Well, no, I don't think. Well, the way he bet, I don't think the big blind had it unless he had a baby flush because he was in the blind.
Right.
But
right.
I don't think the under the gun would. Why would? Yeah, I guess he would shove for just $12
yeah,
more.
You got
yeah,
a flush at that point.
So he's limping
gonna,
with a suited ace. You're
yeah,
thinking, yeah.
Like I said, I mean, why would you leave the extra $12 behind? I mean, you might as well just get it in.
Yeah.
So, I mean, he's the one that I'm more worried about now. So, really, from a profit standpoint, to make this worthy for me, I need to get more money out of the big blind, who I think is behind me.
Yeah.
So, I don't really want to isolate at this point and be heads up against a guy that I might be behind and have to catch up to and get nothing else out of it. I'm fine. Not fine, but I can reconcile my brain losing to that guy's flush if I win a nice side pot off the side that pays for whatever I put in.
Let me ask you this. Now, and I see what you're saying, so I agree with you. I think that you're trying to make more money because even if the under the gun has the nut flush, it makes no difference because we need to try to get more money out of the big blind if we make our boat, if he doesn't, you know what I mean? Because a side pot going to be no matter
yeah,
what.
Because he's
not
going to
fold. Yeah, he's not a factor.
Factor.
But let me ask you this. Let's say you just call the 52 and the big blind calls the 12 mm-hmm. and then another club comes on the turn and now the big blind shoves on you.
Yeah.
And it's not, you know, now you're like, okay, now I have to let the hand go when if I isolated, I could win the entire pot and get this guy to fold his baby flush
yeah,
or whatever. You know what I mean?
Still, if that's the case, and again, I'm assuming that the under gun has the flush already. we still wouldn't have won that pot.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Now, obviously, we don't know what the undergun had, and as it turns out, he really didn't have anything. But what I just said, I was basing on my read that, you know, hey, this big blind made a bet. That's almost always. I think the king with a flush draw is a very legitimate hand for them to have with that move. And then the under the gun, of course, could be making that move with lots of stuff. I wouldn't have guessed pocket eights, but whatever. I would think that I think the story that we laid out is very believable. So at that point, it doesn't matter to me whether another club gets there, because that main pot is. I'm not playing for the main pot necessarily. I'm conceding in my mind that there's a possibility that the main pot, I'm going to have to catch up to win the main pot. I'm just trying to win a side pot.
And you know what else?
The backup
too,
is if I'm wrong on that and I am ahead, then great.
When I first read this, I have to admit that I thought the $40 bet was more than the pot. So I was thinking the guy had a king and no flush draw, and he was trying to protect his hand. That was the first thing I thought.
It must be true, yeah. Absolutely.
You know, and that ends up being what it is. He has ace king with no club. So. To me, yeah, you're right. If the guy just has a king and he's betting 40 and we're just calling, he's going to think we're on a flush draw. And if nothing comes on the turn, he may bet out and you may get more money out of him, you know, if there's no club on the turn. So I agree. It's a tough situation, because, you know, the fact that, yeah, you've put these two guys on pretty narrow hands. And you're adjusting to that. The under the gun could have anything. He could have just a naked club in his hand and no pair. You know, so then you have even, you know, your fours are going to be good at the end, even if you need to make your set. So who knows if this guy doesn't make his flush. So there's a lot of situations that you need to take into consideration. I think we're narrowing it too much by saying under the gun probably has a flush by the way he acted, and big blind probably has top pair, no flush draw, or top pair and a flush draw weak, you know, or I don't know. When I found out the guy had ace king, I was kind of shocked. I mean, I realized you'd be out of position for the hand, but I almost think that you'd want to raise again there and narrow the field a little more than just call and put yourself in the situation that he's in with top pair, top kicker, but no flush possibility redraw. So I was kind of shocked when the guy had ace king there. I really was when I found out later, but the pocket eights was the biggest shock. But anyway, to get back to it, I think that I think either way probably works. But I don't mind trying to pick up that $40 dead money and thinking the under gun doesn't have a flush at this point. You know, maybe he just calls for 40 if he has the nut flush, hoping that 52 shove won't scare people. You know, like I play poker with my family every once in a while, and I can literally get my mom to fold sometimes by just saying all in, even though I only have like $12 in front of me and she has 600.
Yeah, it's a scary thing.
Because the scare tactic. So when you hear all in, you know, so if this guy bets 40 and then the undergun goes, I'm all in and shows 52, he's going to scare people away. So why wouldn't he just call with the $12? I mean, that could be fishy too, but when you're in a multi-hand pot, who knows what you're thinking by just calling? You could just have a naked spade, a club, I mean. So by shoving, I don't necessarily think he has the nut flush or even a flush at that point. He could just have a king with a club in his hand, and you know, or even a 10 king, two pair. I don't know. I mean, it could be all kinds of hands, so I can't narrow it down to the nut flush and say I'm only playing for the big blind's money. I don't mind the shove trying to isolate the under the gun because he has all kinds of hands that could be doing that. So I agree with him. I think he's fine with A and B.
I think the next time you go all in your home game, you should say, Ponzi scheme!
Somehow I'm getting all your chips and you don't even know it. Oh my God, that's great.
All right, Matt, we appreciate you contributing to our situation of the week. And we'll be happy to send you a download of the Poker Hand Breakdown Pro, a hand history analysis program for single or mixed games. From element26.net, and remember to email your hands of the week, your comments, your death threats to podcast@annieupmagazine.com, and if we like any of them, we will include them on a future show and probably send you something.
All right, well, I'm going to go talk to my investor today, make sure he's on the level, and I'm going to throw up Ponzi scheme and see if he knows what that means, and if he does, I'm definitely going to look into it. I'm Chris Cosenza.
And I'm Scott Fong.
We'll see you at the tables.
Annie Up is a production of AnnieUpMagazine.com and is recorded at WDAE 620 AM in Tampa. contact us at podcast@anyupmagazine.com or call our hotline at 813-448-1120. If you'd like to advertise, send us an email at advertising@anyupmagazine.com or call 727-331-4335. Some music used in this episode comes courtesy of the PodSafe Music Network.